Hello, I'm Laura Castleton, U.S. Head of Portfolio Construction and Strategy at Janus Henderson Investors. Is a brighter future possible? At Janus Henderson, we think it is. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. We know that this means our thinking and our investments are helping to shape millions of brighter futures for the next 90 years and beyond. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
I'm Scott Wapner, and you're listening to CNBC's Halftime Report, the podcast, the most profitable hour of the trading day. We record this live weekdays at 12 Eastern. Listen in.
Welcome to the Halftime Report. Scott Wapner here. Front and center this hour, the state of stocks. Amazon earnings just hours away now, and fresh stagflation fears dragging down stocks today. The investment committee debating all of that. Joining me for the hour, Josh Brown, Stephanie Link, Jim Labenthal. Check the markets. We are, well, lows of the day for the Dow. We're down 300 points right now. S&P's given back about 2/3 of 1%. Steph, I come to you first. So employment cost index jumps by the most in a year. Chicago PMI now 20 months under 50, under 40. That's ugly.
Mm-hmm.
Consumer confidence under 100. That's the lowest since July of 2022. What's going on here?
I think it's way too premature to talk about stagflation.
Yeah, that's the word of the day, the dreaded S word.
I know, but I think it's way too premature. I think that 1.6% GDP number last week is going to get revised higher because I think the consumer was misrepresented. If you look at all the numbers, the wage numbers that we've been getting in the ECI today, up 4.3% year over year, that's great for the consumer. If you look at the PCE last week, income and spending grew 5 and 6% respectively. That's great for the consumer. Manufacturing, we talk about it all the time, and I had a whole slew of companies today that reported earnings in the manufacturing industry, and they are on fire, parts of manufacturing.
Why consumer confidence then? If it's so great for the consumer, why is confidence now the lowest since July of 2022? Something's going on.
I think it ebbs and flows, and I think it has a lot to do with, maybe there is elevated inflation. We've talked about that, but it's coming under control. I mean, the core PCE number was pretty good. I mean, it was like a ho-hum, actually. It was right in line with expectations. It didn't massively accelerate. So, look, if the Fed doesn't cut, which is what I've been saying now for quite a while, if they don't cut this year, they don't have to cut this year because the economy continues to grow. And that's why I think it's really important to talk about the revisions that I'm expecting in the first quarter GDP report. I think that that is going to be a game changer when they do revise it.
All right, Jimmy. This seems to be today about that S word. Stagflation. That's like the thing that the Fed would fear more than anything else, theoretically. It's like Jason showing up with the hockey mask at the meeting, right?
Yeah.
I mean, is that what this is about?
I don't think stagflation is the issue. Obviously, it's on people's minds, Scott, no question about it. And I think that started last Friday with the hotter than expected PCE number. But talking about today's number, the ECI, let's just remember that's another first quarter number. I mean, this is, I think, the very last first quarter number that we're going to get. My eyes are what's going on in April. Tomorrow we're going to get the ISM manufacturing. You'd mentioned just a second ago, Stephanie, that manufacturing tentatively, very tentatively, looks like it's starting to grow again. Now, we can either have that confirmed or denied tomorrow, but that's important. And then the labor market, Scott, with the average hourly earnings growth, that's where we're going to get the first hint of what inflation's doing in April. So I get it. Everybody's worried about inflation based on first quarter numbers, which across the board from the start to the end of the first quarter were terrible. I'd like to start looking forward. As far as the stag part goes, I have a problem with that because you have unemployment below 4%. I actually do remember the 70s. I remember double-digit employment. I remember being in a bond family that had bond inventory as interest rates were going through the roof and Paul Volcker was doing everything to crush inflation. It was a very unpleasant time. This just doesn't remind me of it.
Even if, I mean, eventually, you know, there are concerns that the consumer is tapping out or starting to tap out, at least to some degree. And that, you know, I hear both of you respectfully.
It's okay. Go.
Explaining away it all. Explaining away.
Yes.
The sticky inflation.
Let me do this.
I don't think we're explaining it away. I mean, Look at Hilton. Look at Marriott. Look at services.
Yeah.
That continues to be on fire. Consumer is still spending. Savings rate, absolutely, I'll give it to you that it's come down, but it's still at 3%. And jobs, if you want a job, you can get a job. There's 1.2 jobs available for every one unemployed person in this country. And if the labor market is tight, wages are going higher, that is wonderful consumer.
Let's be clear.
That's a tailwind.
Let's be clear. I'm not suggesting that we have a problem of stagflation now. Today, tomorrow, next week, or next month. But when you get a GDP number that was a disappointment, and you've now had, we can, you know, whatever, with the PCI, get it. That's the Fed's preferred measure, and it was okay.
Fine.
Relative to the last few CPIs. But if you continue to get reads of sticky inflation, and, you know, you get a Chicago PMI of 30, under 38, and you can't have consumer confidence start to wane. Jim, at some point, you got to stand up and say, we might have an issue here.
At some point. And you said eventually before, and I agree with you. It's not, you can't, I don't think that Steph and I are explaining it away, but at some point, this chicken has to come home to roost. And what that looks like is either inflation comes down and you get the rate cuts in the future. Where Jason shows up, Jason Voorhees shows up, is if we start talking about rate hikes. That's where you've got me scared, like I didn't see him, you know, coming out of the water and swamping that canoe at the end of Friday the 13th, just if anybody didn't get the reference. That's, you want to scare me? I've said this for some weeks, rate hikes, that scares me.
So Josh Brown, you want to tell me what you're thinking before we get to Amazon?
Yeah, there's no stagflation. And the most problematic part of this conversation and what Jim and Stephanie haven't really addressed yet is there's actually no such animal as quote unquote the consumer. Which consumer? Because right now when you hear companies saying that there's trading down or that there was like a little bit of cost pressure in some of their segments, when you hear McDonald's and others say that, they're talking about a very specific part of the consumer base, the lowest income quintile. They are struggling right now. Their credit card, the rates on credit cards are through the roof. They're not able to refinance the way that they could have a couple of years ago. Car leases are problematic. Energy prices have risen. Absolutely, there's pressure. Here's the thing, though. The lowest income quintile, that is the 20% of U.S. consumers at the bottom of the income scale, are only 9% of overall consumption. The highest income quintile, the top 20%, who are quite frankly right now driving the bus, according to Federal Reserve data, were 38% of spending last quarter, and that probably hasn't changed. The next highest 20% is 23%. It's almost two-thirds of the economy is being driven by spending from the top 40%. There is absolutely no change to that consumer. Mm. So when we say the consumer this, the consumer that, these things have nothing to do with each other. So we have to be really careful about prophesying stagflation because of, you know, a couple of things that we're hearing on some earnings reports. I'm going to give you the bottom line
no
here.
No one's calling you look for at, it. No yes, one's calling for it. But
companies
let's be
that have
clear.
Reported.
But let's
seen
be
46%
clear.
Of them so far.
Hang on a second. Hang on a second. No one's calling for it. But it obviously is in the conversation of worries as to why, when you get numbers like you did, you get a stock market reaction like you have. When the employment cost index goes up, rates back up, then you get a couple of economic reads that are ugly, and then stocks go down. So it's in the conversation. I don't think we're sitting here as some sort of prophecy, you know, suggesting that it's around the corner. Or even probable. But the fear of that word is enough to drag stocks down.
Yeah, but I'll go back to the earnings point that I wanted to make, which is that we've got half the companies having reported. 77% have beaten on earnings. 60% have beaten on revenue. That's pretty good. Well, the last 5 years, the average earnings per share beat rate is 77%. So we're kind of right on target. Now, you think about what's working in the market as a result of what you're talking about. If the market really believed that stagflation is coming later this year narrative, I think the leadership would probably not be what it is right now. Only 37% of technology stocks in the S&P 500 are below their 50-day, which means almost three quarters of the index, two thirds of the index are still in short term bull markets. Mm-hmm. Discretionary, only 38% are below a 50 day. Most of those stocks are still in their own individual bull market. If the stagflation narrative was really having an impact on psychology, Judge, I just don't think that the market would look the way it looks right now.
Well, I mean, look, it's a day. It's a few hours. It's not it isn't anything yes. that we are True. Spending days and weeks discussing. And by the way, we've been here before.
Just
right.
When?
Last week, you have GDP coming in light. You have a hotter inflation read and the market gets all upset. And then what happens? Mega cap earnings come and save the day. We had the best week in the stock market since November mm-hmm. last week, even in the face of all that. I bring that up because are we going to get a part two tonight where Amazon reports and reminds us of why we're here in the first place and the kinds of stocks that we've bet on in the first place and calms everything down again?
Amazon is going to be great. It is. It's absolutely going to be great. And it'll help us all feel a little bit better
Love
about
that.
The consumer. Okay, so the problem I have is the stock is up 18% year to date, and numbers have been creeping higher for AWS to be 15, maybe 16% from 13% last quarter.
Well, the 13 is the estimate. So you're talking about, you raise a great point. The whisper is much higher than what the estimate is. So that means the bar is higher.
That's absolutely right. That's why I say that's the problem. I think the report is going to be very strong. AWS is just a piece of that. Retail, online stores expected to be 7% growth. I think that's going to be great. I think margins are going to be great. They've done a great job in terms of cost cutting, and the fulfillment center build out is done. So I think it is going to be, and oh, by the way, advertising I also think is going to be an upside surprise as well. Again, I just think the expectations are super high. I trimmed a little bit last couple of weeks. I would be more than happy to be buying it back. If it's weak.
Josh, you also have, you know, these, and I think Meta is kind of caught in the same thing of these AI aspirations versus cost cutting, right? Meta stock performance, they learn the hard way. When you condition a marketplace that you've gotten over your excessive spending, or at least large amounts of it, and then you come back, even if it's for something as believable as investors believe in AI, you sort of take a pause. And I wonder what the impact might be on Amazon if they come out and say, well, our cost cutting's got to take a back seat for a minute because we need to ramp. We need to spend on AI because that's the next growth area.
So I think Amazon is a different animal from Meta. I get your point, but I think Amazon is a different animal from Meta because a lot of the AI quote unquote spending that's taking place is being spent with Amazon. So that's, by the way, there's a reason why the numbers are creeping up. And that reason is both Microsoft and Google had their cloud sales accelerate last quarter versus the sequentially prior quarter. So, you know, it's not like out of the blue, all of a sudden everyone's excited. It's unlikely that you saw the acceleration you saw at the other two and not at AWS, which is arguably one of the better of the three, or of the, let's say, the five biggest cloud platforms. I think, though, also part of the story here is that, you know, this is a stock where they have, first of all, it's the only $1 trillion company that doesn't pay a dividend yet. So we'll see if there's going to be a capital return story here. I think there might be. That's number one. Number two, the advertising business here is also growing as fast or faster than the cloud business. So I don't think the focus has to just be what's the AWS number, and then we just trade off of that. This is now the third biggest advertising business in the country. And again, that is a growth business for Amazon. And then the cost-cutting story. You know, you talk about, like, is Meta spending too much? Is the street all of a sudden more focused on, well, where are the profits from AI, et cetera, as Stephanie and I have talked about for a long time, Amazon has had tons of room to cut excess spending from all different areas of the business. Mm-hmm. And so I think if they give guidance there, that effort continues, that also should be good enough for the street tonight.
Jimmy, sales are expected at a record, but, you know, Steph pointed to the year-to-date move in the stock. It's also up more than 70% in the past year.
Yeah.
Ben? Is that an asset or a liability?
It depends on how you look at it. The way I look at it is if you go back the last 3.5 years, it's basically flat. I mean, it was August of 2020 that it first reached the level that it's at right now. And it's had some sharp moves up and down in those 3.5 years. It recently actually broke out to a new all-time high. I think we all marked that on the show. That
we
was
did?
About 2 weeks ago. Yeah, it did.
Yes, we
know.
I said
oh,
we did.
Sorry, yeah. And look, it pulled back with the market the last couple of weeks. But it really seems to me like it's set up for a breakout to higher levels. The overall performance of the company is startling. I'm looking on FactSet right now, just at net income, right? I mean, that's what we own stocks for, is their net income. Net income has tripled at this company over the last 5 years. And, you know, of those 5 years, 3.5 years, the stock's done nothing. I'm pretty comfortable owning Amazon right here. I think of all the large cap techs, this is the one that's probably the most positioned, even after Microsoft and Google, to outperform in its earnings.
The other one that's tonight, too, is AMD, right? Not to be forgotten about, because it's important. Josh, I'm going to get your take on it in a second because you have recent ownership in it. I know you don't have it anymore, but Christina Partsinevelos is sitting at the desk with us today here at Post 9 because you cover this. And, you know, how should we think about this in an environment where it's so dramatically underperformed some of these other bigger names?
Yeah, especially the stock in just the last month. There's been a pullback of almost, you know, 15%. I think the concern with AMD is that you still have part of its business that is cyclical in nature. It is exposed to PCs, 20% of revenue. It is exposed to, you know, to more traditional servers. And we know from Intel, TSMC, a list of others, ASML, they've all talked about, you know, weakness in the first Q1 and Q2 and then improvement in the second half. So that is not necessarily good news for AMD, which is why we're going to be looking for any type of trends on those two categories. But on the flip side, all of this talk about CapEx spend, the AI chip, their MI300, more specifically the MI300X, they had previously said the full year 2024 estimate was going to be $3.5 billion. I say this because that number is extremely important. If they increase that estimate to about $5 billion, which is what the street is anticipating, then you'll see shares react very positively. Buy side even has that number as high as $8 billion. So that's the commentary that we're going to be looking for specifically with this MI300 series AI chip that is going to be the competitor to NVIDIA's H100, H200.
What's the easiest answer for why the stock has underperformed these other names so dramatically?
Well,
whether it's a Broadcom, which is up 20% year to date, right? AMD's only up 9. Okay, let's just put that on the table. NVIDIA, for example, top of the heap, up 76%. Why is it?
You're describing AI plays versus those that are not necessarily solely AI plays. More than 50% of AMD's business comes from embedded gaming, PCs, and those don't necessarily benefit from this big AI boom.
Yeah, but they've made it pretty clear that they're coming, right?
That the improvement's coming in those segments is what you're asking.
Yeah, on AI.
In the second half.
Well, so some of these other companies are getting the benefit of the doubt.
But Broadcom and Marvell are specifically for custom AI chips, and so they're actually benefiting in the near term. Broadcom, for example, has the collaboration with Google, so there's that difference, which is why they're seeing a bigger upside right now versus AMD that is still exposed to the cyclical nature of the chip space.
All right, they need to talk about AI like 3,000 times on the call.
There's AI fatigue to a certain point now, where, you know, some investors. Like, we're not seeing the actual monetization. I know this goes into greater tech as a whole, but there's only so much you can say AI and say that it's going to bring in revenues, and then it doesn't.
You still, Steph, prefer the Broadcoms and the Lambs to the AMDs?
Yeah. I mean, actually, I trimmed both a couple of weeks ago. I would buy Lam Research right back. After the quarter last week, it was very good. They raised wafer fab equipment spend again. This is the third quarter in a row. Gross margins are structurally higher than prior cycles, so they're much more profitable. And actually, I think that they do have an AI component to it. We've talked about memory needing six times, AI being memory six times. You need six times as much memory for AI. And this is a memory player. So to me, this is one I want to own. It's not down enough, but if we get a couple of days like today, because it's not so pretty, I might buy it back.
Josh, you sold AMD, as I mentioned, a few months back.
Yeah, to answer your question, my opinion is, like, why does it look like this? By the way, right in the middle of the pack, if you rank it versus the other semis, it's up about 9% year to date, but it's the 12th best performer out of 26 names in the SMH ETF. So it's not bad, it's just not great. But to answer your question as to why, I think the bar is too high. Expectations have gone up a lot. I think they can deliver, but it's not enough to deliver. You have to deliver and shock people to the upside. That's like the environment that we're in. The stock's trading 300 times earnings, 44 times forward, fine, cheaper, LOL. Analysts are looking for $2.3 billion in data center revenue for this quarter. To put that into context, they did $1.3 billion last year. So analysts are looking for $1 billion in incremental spend in that category year over year. I think they can do it, but like, is that going to be enough? So 20 cents in earnings, up from a loss of 9 cents last year. Again, the bar is super high here. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think it looks the way it does. Technically, the stock is in no man's land. I get interested in it if it falls after earnings. I agree with Stephanie. I love the name. I just don't want to pay for it where it is. And I don't like the sloppiness of the chart.
Ben, one, I'll give you the last word, Christina. I mean, this has been a darling over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. Clearly, until the AI story sort of took over everything. And now you find out the winners from the losers, at least in the near term, apparently.
Yeah, and
not as a loser, but you know what I mean. Yeah, the winners from the just astronomical.
So the first mover advantage of NVIDIA, of the likes of those custom chip makers you mentioned, Marvell, Broadcom, even the memory makers, too, because they benefit from the high bandwidth memory that is needed in a lot of these AI chips. Specifically, AMD doesn't produce that. So even Samsung's results earlier this morning prove that. And so these are benefits for Micron, et cetera, SK Hynix, not necessarily AMD at the moment, unless they blow it out of the water right now at their data center forecast for the MI300.
All right. Thanks for the setup. Appreciate it. Christina Partsinevelos. Speaking of setups, it's interesting. Coming off the week we just had, I said the best week for the S&P since November. You did have people apparently getting more bullish because you've had, according to Bank of America's equity client flows, the biggest equity inflow in some 8 weeks. What are we buying? What are their clients buying? Staples, high on the list. Speaking of, Stephanie Link's new buy, a fresh buy. P&G.
A fresh buy, right? We talked about it last week. I own no staples, so I was looking for one. And when I saw this quarter, it was actually very good. Organic growth of 7%, sales up 4%, gross margins up 300 basis points. I mean, that is just amazing. It's productivity, it's pricing. I like their product set. So it's not cheap by any means, but I just think that this is a really solid story, and it's kind of a defensive position to offset some of the more cyclical stuff that I have.
I'm glad you used the word defensive, because that's sort of where I was going off of this buy. And I wonder, you know, if you look at our Fed survey, for example, stocks outlook and the risks, the respondents on the Fed survey that Steve Leisman does says that stocks have largely put in gains for the year. So maybe, you know, buying some staples positions fits perfectly with that as we bring our senior economics reporter, Steve Leisman, into the conversation as we begin the Fed meeting. We get the decision, of course, in the news conference tomorrow, as we know that things have taken a more hawkish turn, Steve.
Yeah, they've begun to dial out rate cuts this year, Scott, along with the futures market, but maybe a little bit more hawkish than the futures market's done, Scott. A couple things in this survey. The only 50% or greater month for a rate cut is actually December now. They're 48-48 in September. So they have an average of 1.6 cuts dialed in. And you can see here what you're looking at is something different, Scott. That is the actual futures market. And that's come off a lot from this morning's ECI index. Market has, price-wise, thrown out June, thrown out July, and now pretty much working on throwing out September, which is in line with our forecast, Scott, at that 50% range. So it's really up in the air now, a jump ball. I don't know what you want to call it, as to whether or not there's one or two cuts this year and whether or not there's any at all. Because the other thing, they did move cuts into 2025. So we do have that in front of us, and that's when the 29 respondents have better returns for the stock market is in 2025. So that might be a story for there. But they also raised the neutral rate, which brings up this idea of how tight the Fed is. And one of the things we're on the edge of our seat about tomorrow, Scott, is does Powell introduce a little bit more two-sided risk to the direction of rates?
Well, look, I'm sure tomorrow during the news conference that somebody in the room is going to end up asking a question to the chair regarding stagflation. And I'm curious as to how you're thinking about how they're thinking about that fear at this point.
You know, Scott, I'm sort of curious as to why stagflation has become such a go-to possibility? As I look back on the history, Scott, I think we've had one bout of stagflation in like 50 years. For stagflation to happen, something has to go wrong. The price mechanism has to be on the fritz, in the sense that if you have the stag part of this, in other words, no growth or even negative growth, then the normal result is that prices should begin to ease, or inflation should begin to ease. That's what you would expect. That's normally what happens. You have one bout, the 1980s, I believe it was, early 80s, when you had no growth and high inflation. And that was maybe because of the idea of what was happening with oil prices and the cartel jacking up and keeping oil prices high. Inflation expectations got out of control, bad monetary policy. Stagflation is an outlier of a possibility. The more poignant conversation, or the more likely conversation, is one of, do we have a recession? And is that recession what is needed to bring down prices to the Fed's target? That's mm-hmm. really where the conversation, I think, is the more sort of odds-on probable conversation.
Well, and let's just pick up quickly where you just left off, because you said something yesterday that really stuck with me, and you alluded to it just now. The idea that when we started this whole thing, the Fed thought it had to crush demand and raise unemployment to get inflation under control.
Right.
Then inflation started dropping precipitously while growth remained strong. And then it pivoted to the conversation about, hey, let's not break what we don't really have to break. We can still get inflation down and we can keep the economy strong. You said something yesterday, though, to the effect of maybe we're coming back to where we were before, where now we could be facing, and the Fed survey showed this, higher growth, higher inflation. Does the Fed need to now do more that they figured they didn't have to do to get inflation down to target?
Yeah, I mean, welcome to Act Three, Scott, of the endless play of the economy that we're in here. I think Act One was the concern about that. Act Two was the idea that it didn't come to fruition. And Act Three, maybe the rekindling of that. We have in our survey, Scott, 50% of respondents think that you need both below potential growth and a higher unemployment rate of a half a point or higher in order to get to the Fed's 2% target. Now, if you don't have those, can you count on more supply side improvement? Well, you know, Larry Summers has a tweet out I want to read to you, Scott, that just came out a few minutes ago, where he said the Federal Reserve's in a treacherous environment, should have been more careful about easing signals, and now should be very cautious about possible rate cutting. Now, Larry's not saying they're introducing this two-sided risk, but I am talking to some people who think that the Fed ought to put the market on notice that a cut is not a given for the next move for the Federal Reserve.
Interesting. Steve, thanks. See much of you over the next
Pleasure.
Couple of days. Look forward to that, Steve Leisman. Up next, more moves from Steph in her portfolio, just adding to two key positions. Break them down when we come back. Plus, spin-off success stories, why big breakups have been a big win for investors. Going to show you our chart of the day. Pretty interesting story next.
Hello, I'm Laura Castleton, U.S. Head of Portfolio Construction and Strategy at Janus Henderson Investors. Is a brighter future possible? At Janus Henderson, we think it is. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. We know that this means our thinking and our investments are helping to shape millions of brighter futures for the next 90 years and beyond. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
B2B selling is tougher than ever, and we feel your pain. If you're struggling to close deals, consider giving LinkedIn Sales Navigator a shot. This sales intelligence platform helps professionals like you engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator also guides you in targeting the right buyers, highlights key signals such as job changes or which accounts you should prioritize, and uncovers hidden hot prospects so you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/halftimereport. That is linkedin.com/halftimereport for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/halftimereport and get started.
All right, welcome back. We have some committee stocks on the move today. GE Healthcare, on pace for its worst day ever. Sorry.
No.
Well, you bought more of it.
I did.
So, I mean, you're laughing all the way to the buy more button.
Yeah, well, I had to. It's down 12%. I mean, I think it's an overreaction, but you can't miss in this environment. The stock is up 40% from the October lows. So they missed earnings, they missed revenue, but I still like what they're doing in services. I think their book to bill being over one is good. Orders are still there. They did see some volumes softness in imaging and ultrasound. I think that's going to come back. So the problem is now their guidance, which they reiterated, it's like back half loaded, and no one likes that. But I do think that this company is really set up very well over the next several years. So that's why I'm adding to it.
Okay. You bought more 3M as well?
I did. I think that stock should be up a lot more. I mean, earnings were up 17%, operating income up 22%. Their margins were up over 300 basis points year over year and handedly beat the street. So to me, I think this is just the beginning. Bill Brown starts tomorrow. And so then now you have a great leader with a proven track record at L3Harris. When he was at L3Harris, the stock rose over 400% in a 10-year span. Mm-hmm. So I like it very much.
It reminded us of just how well some of these spinoffs have done, these spinoff success stories, what we're calling it. Our chart of the day, want you to take a look at the spinoff index, the ETF that tracks this. From the October low, October 27th, to today, up 31.5%. Dominated by industrials.
Yeah.
No big surprise, right? Vernova, GE Vernova, that was obviously spun off from GE. Mm-hmm. Veralto spun off from Danaher. You've got GE Healthcare, we just talked about. Solventum spun off from 3M. You have others on this list. Why is this working so well? Industrials, by the way, have an index weighting of near half.
Yeah. I mean, spins definitely work. It unlocks value. You have the management team that's 100% focused now on the one business, not three or four different businesses. And the interesting thing is you actually get the proper sell-side analyst coverage. Because when GE was covered by the industrials, the healthcare piece and the power and the renewables business got ignored and was underappreciated. And so when you spin them out, you can actually focus 100% of your attention. By the way, one of my very best spins mm-hmm. was Zoetis. Remember back in 2013, they spun out from Pfizer. The stock's up 500% since then. It's not been a good stock this year, but it's been a great spin.
The other breakdown, well, speaking of Zoetis, I mean, if you want to put healthcare is 15% of the index weight. That's second. Sure. Technology is number three. Josh, how do you think about spinoffs and whether they're going to be successful or not, whether it's a reason to buy into a name?
So I think like there, I think it's an individual story dependent thing, but the premise of the spinoff, Stephanie is absolutely right. The academic literature is pretty clear. The thing that's really interesting is very often the best approach is to hold both the parent company and the spinco and not choose between the two, because then you have two focused management teams. And then you often, so we focus a lot on the baby, but oftentimes the parent becomes unencumbered. Much like my wife and I in July when our kids are at summer camp. So I feel like when you have a spinoff and a lot of spinoffs happening in a sector, we've seen this in energy, we've seen this in industrials and healthcare. Oftentimes there's just a refocus happening and you want to keep both pieces. And I've seen that work very successfully. As far as just buying the spincos though, Scott, mm-hmm. I think you want to know what you're buying. And, mm-hmm. you know, they're obviously always different situations.
You know, the other just reminded me as we're having this conversation, Steph, is you own IBM. You did not buy Kyndryl though.
No, I didn't.
Why?
I didn't really like the business I mean, it's been not a bad stock, but I just didn't like that business. I just liked the fact that IBM was just getting smaller, shrinking to grow. I just preferred it, so I put all my money back into IBM.
Ah, interesting. All right, let's get the headlines now with Pippa Stevens. Hey, Pippa.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the Gaza aid pier will be ready in a week while speaking to reporters at a warehouse for a Jordanian charity. The pier, which is currently being built offshore by U.S. troops, will help move humanitarian aid into Gaza, where the UN says people are on the brink of famine. An expert panel now recommends breast cancer screenings start at age 40, reversing guidance that women wait until 50. The U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, which issued the new guidance, cited rising rates of breast cancer among women.
B2B selling is tougher than ever, and we feel your pain. If you're struggling to close deals, consider giving LinkedIn Sales Navigator a shot. This sales intelligence platform helps professionals like you engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator also guides you in targeting the right buyers, highlights key signals such as job changes or which accounts you should prioritize, and uncovers hidden hot prospects so you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/halftimereport. That is linkedin.com/halftimereport for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/halftimereport and get started.
In their 40s. Rates have gone up 2% every year from 2015 to 2019, though some researchers argue the guidance does not go far enough. And the Environmental Protection Agency finalized a ban on a chemical widely used in paint strippers. Officials say methylene chloride is known to cause liver cancer and other health problems. The new rule comes just weeks after the EPA banned asbestos. Scott, back to you.
All right, Pippa. Thank you. Pippa Stevens. Coming up, calls of the day, including a bullish one on Live Nation ahead of its earnings. Josh owns it. We trade it. We'll do it next. Keep an eye on the markets this final trading day of the month of April, shaping up to be the difficult one. Dow's down about 400, S&P 500 down about 45 points. That's less than 1%, obviously, on the S&P. But we'll continue to watch that as we do our calls of the day. Live Nation, Josh, initiated by Deutsche, price target 120. That's 30% up from here. Stock reports on Thursday, it is having a terrible month. It's the worst one since September of 22. Why?
It's down about 10% since the Wall Street Journal reported on an investigation or whatever's going to happen. The analyst agrees with what I think here. I'll just quote what they're saying. We believe the most likely outcome of a potential regulatory investigation will be pro-consumer reforms, which shouldn't be materially disruptive to Live Nation's business opportunity, and not a more drastic structural remedy. So you have a company that's going to deliver double-digit earnings growth for as far as the eye can see, a one-of-a-kind asset. It's really a jewel. It's an area of entertainment and leisure that they are the best player, the best possible way to invest there, and they are a very high-level operator from Michael Rapino all the way on down. So I'm a long-term investor here, and I think the stock under $100 is a gift.
Okay. Jimmy, Citi was called the favorite stock in Oppenheimer's Q1 2024 bank review today.
I feel like that's been happening more and more in the past 6 months or so, that more and more banks are getting behind Citibank in terms of research coverage and believing in it. And I think it should have happened a long time earlier. The company is clearly streamlining itself, pays a nice dividend at about 3.5%, buys back shares by the ton at 70% of tangible book value. And Jane Fraser, the CEO there, has had a credible plan for over 3 years. It's just now being recognized. I think there's more room to run.
Let's debate Boeing with you guys. Downgraded today at Argus, okay? We know about the troubles that the stock has had. Steph, you own it, okay? Jim, you did own it. You did love it. You sold it, and you wouldn't touch it. Steph, about this call. It's down 30% year to date.
Oh, yes, I know. I definitely know.
And sorry to have to remind you that.
I've been saying for a while it's dead money until they hire and make the announcement of the CEO. In the meantime, I'm thinking longer term. They have 5,600 planes in their backlog, valued at $450 billion, up $7 billion from last quarter alone. Mm-hmm. They will get through the 737 MAX issue, and when they do, they will eventually get to 50 planes produced a month. It's going to take some time, but I'm sticking with it because it is down so much. And oh, by the way, it was really interesting yesterday. They had a $10 billion debt deal that was 8 times oversubscribed yesterday that was announced. That's why the stock was up 4%. So it's not going to take much.
Okay, so Steph, I mean, you know how I feel about the company.
Yep.
737 MAX, yes, they will get through it. Yes, they will get through all the crises they're facing right now. And the reason they will is because Scott knows it, you know it, I know it, everybody knows it. Boeing needs to exist. The government knows it. The airlines know it. The nation knows that Boeing needs to exist. My concern here has been, since the Alaska Airlines disaster, is that the government's going to have to step in here to really get their operations on track. I hope I'm wrong. You know I hope I'm wrong. But I'm worried the government's going to have to step in here and basically say, to hell with profits. We need Boeing to work. Period.
I feel like they already are doing that. That's why they can't get back to 38 planes a month. That's why they delivered like three last month. So I think it's going to take some time, but I think eventually it will happen.
All right. Well, you've had patience with some other stories that have been taking a little time, and they've worked. Patience is a virtue. You ever hear that?
All right. Yes, I have.
All right. Still ahead, we're trading some of today's big earnings movers beyond Amazon and AMD. And Mike Santoli's on the other side of this quick break with his midday word. Our senior markets commentator, Mike Santoli, here for his midday word with the Dow now down about 423. I guess we've had too many sticky inflation reads for comfort.
Yes.
At this point. And this is part of the reaction.
It's part of the reaction. And therefore, the Treasury market continues to test the equity market. I think that, you know, when it comes to actually what Powell says tomorrow, everyone's pretty hawked up already. I mean, the numbers tell you should be in a way that there's not met the threshold for greater confidence that inflation is heading toward target. On the other hand, there's no dot plot to have to explain away, right? So we don't have that this meeting. He can kind of take whatever stance and say he's data dependent. We already kind of know what the data are. So that tells me, I'm not sure there's a ton of surprises, but the numbers are what they are, which is you can't quite be comfortable, even if we talk our way around some of the extraordinary items, about the inflation side. So it's static. It's good growth. Its earnings are coming through fine. Mm-hmm. And it's what do you pay for them in this environment at this point in the cycle?
The bulls cannot leave the meeting tomorrow even thinking about a hike. That fully upsets the story. I mean, we expect hawkish, at least a hawkish tilt.
Yeah.
But if he goes there, we probably have a problem.
Well, it's a question of how he goes there. Is it an acknowledgement that the risks are balanced on either side and who knows what the data are going to tell us to do? Fine. I don't think he's going to fully withdraw this idea that he believes rates are restrictive where they are relative to where they think neutral is. That would be a big surprise. If he basically says, listen, this economy is impervious to 5.25% Fed funds, and therefore we have to go higher, I doubt he's going to say
that. Sure, but, you know, irrespective of what all of the other Fed speakers since the last meeting have said, he's the one who has repeatedly made you believe that they're done, right?
Sure.
They're done.
Well, the way you say you're done is you say we still believe policy is restrictive and, you know, it'll be appropriate to normalize it at some point. It's going to be that kind of Fed speak. I really think the market most wants to get through it.
Yeah.
And then figure out where we are in terms of tabulating the earnings picture. And then on a tactical basis, we got this bounce. It failed right at the 50-day average. And now the sellers are going to come out and say maybe there's more to be done here on the downside.
We'll see what it looks like when I see you on closing bell. Yep. Look forward to that. Mike Santoli joining me, of course, at 3 o'clock. Coming up, we're going to set you up. We have a lot of stocks on the move today. Owned by the committee. There's NXP, we got Eaton, we got Rig. We'll trade all those next. All right, some committee stocks on the move today. NXP, they beat. Jimmy, you own it. You trimmed it a couple of months ago. We can take a look at the performance of the stock. There it is. It is up 1.75%.
This has been a little unsung darling in my portfolio for several years. Having said that, the earnings report wasn't a blowout. It just wasn't a blowout. The guidance was okay. It was kind of in line. And they're pointing to a second half recovery in the auto sector in particular. Obviously, expectations were very low here with what's going on with Tesla and other electric vehicle manufacturers. I think, though, that this is getting a little long in the tooth for me. I'm having a hard time saying that. But it's getting a little long in the tooth. So I did trim it a couple of months ago. It may not be long for my portfolio.
Wow. Okay. You keep us up to date, please.
Yep, I will.
Eaton, Stephanie Link, new all-time high today. Take a look at that stock as we throw it to you.
And it's reversed. I think it's
reversed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why is it reversed?
I think it's just sell the news. I mean, the stock's had such a nice run. It's not cheap by any means, but they really did have a very good quarter. Electrical ran the show, if you will, up 17%. Aerospace up 9% in sales. Really solid results from those two big parts of the company. Margins up 630 basis points, talks to price mix. So if it continues to pull back, I will be adding to it.
Jimmy, you want to take on RIG, Transocean?
Yeah.
Better than expected loss.
Yeah.
Right? Revenues missed.
Yes, and an EBITDA beat, which is what you're really looking for. So why is the stock down 11%? I talked yesterday about the fact that we need these idle rigs to come back online in active contracts. That is actually on track, but clearly people were hoping for it to happen a lot sooner than it looks like it's going to happen. Here's what the company said on the call. The active fleet for the entire industry is going to be all used up, all contracted out by the end of the year. And then there will be calls on those idle rigs. They said, we're not going to be the first to go. We're going to hold out for the higher price. That's what they've always done. Just be a little patient here. This 11% decline is way overdone.
Hey,
however, yes, Josh.
Why wouldn't they do a reverse split? Why are they allowing this stock? It's been a penny stock for five years. What are they thinking?
I think the answer is it's so darn volatile, Josh. I mean, it was at 8, it's at 4, now it's at 5 and change. I think they're thinking it's going higher from here. Maybe they're wrong, but I think it is going higher from here.
The stock for 7 years now has been under 10.
Yeah.
It just seems like very unshareholder friendly.
Just to be helpful really quickly, go back to before the pandemic. They are approaching those financial numbers in terms of revenue and income, and the stock was above 10 then. I'm not arguing with you. I'm just saying, like, it should be higher.
Okay. We'll take a quick break.
I feel you.
Yep.
Finals are next. Okay, Jim.
Happy.
Stephanie Link.
Raytheon.
Josh. No Josh.
Amazon.
No seat. No one there.
Amazon.
See you on the bell. I'll see you on the closing bell.
You've been listening to CNBC's Halftime Report, the podcast. You can always catch us live weekdays at 12 Eastern, only on CNBC.
All opinions expressed by the Halftime Report participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company, or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Halftime Report participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and/or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Halftime Report disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/halftime-report-disclaimer.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.